The listeners will recall that in the previous installment, we were telling the tales told by Rav Baruch Botlin, the grandfather, great-grandfather of the Alter Rebbe, the grandfather of Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, and we were at the point where King Ferdinand, in the year 1556 approximately, declared that the Jews of Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia were to leave in a short period of time, I believe it's 2 years, the country because of the anti-Semitic incitements by the Catholic Church. And we continue now the story of what happened with that decree. It happened that the king called together a meeting of his advisors and princes. His two sons, Ferdinand and Maximilian, were among them. The reason the meeting was called was to try and find ways and means of replenishing the empty coffers of the royal treasury. And another subject of discussion was in relation to the expulsion of the Jews from the land. Although the two brothers, Prince Ferdinand and Prince Maximilian, were friendly in their relationship toward each other, they were very far apart in character. Thus, they did not confide in each other and knew little of each other's affairs. Now that they had been brought together at this meeting, they took the opportunity of having a chat. They were discussing their estates and how they were being managed. Maximilian complained that he had no profit at all from his estates. In fact, they were a loss to him. "I am up to my ears in debt," he told his brother. "And how goes it with you?" Ferdinand told him that he was doing excellently and was very pleased indeed with the income he was deriving from his estates. Maximilian opened his eyes in astonishment and exclaimed, "But my estates are at least as large as yours and certainly more valuable. How is it then that you manage to make a profit while I only make losses?" "My manager is the one who can give you the best answer to that," said Ferdinand. "I surely would like to meet this magician of yours," said Maximilian. "Tell me who he is." "It happens that my manager is an old Jew who has been looking after the estates for the past 50 years. I inherited him together with these estates," was Ferdinand's reply. "I can hardly believe that you would employ a Jew to manage your estates," exclaimed Maximilian, his eyes wide open in a horrified surprise. "My manager is a German, a man of understanding and knowledge, a real nobleman." "But now you see the difference between your manager and mine," answered Ferdinand. Meanwhile, the king reminded his son Maximilian that he still had not paid what he owed to the government treasury. A comprehensive investigation showed that the prince was head over heels in debt and had no prospect of getting out of the unpleasant position in which he found himself. The king could not understand what had happened to his son's estates. Could it be that he was extravagant and a spendthrift? The king was of a steady character himself and was determined to get to the bottom of this leakage. The king sent his own men to Maximilian's estates to examine the affairs there, and to their astonishment they discovered that the manager, about whom Prince Maximilian had such an exalted opinion, was a common thief. He had helped himself to large sums of money out of the income from the estates. The German king ordered this German swindler to be arrested. But this was not much help to Maximilian. He was still in the same straits. He went in desperation to his brother Prince Ferdinand and poured out his bitter woes. "I will talk to my manager," suggested Ferdinand. "I am sure that with his clever brain he will find some way of helping you." Maximilian was too desperate to speak lightly of Jews this time, and was only too glad to leave it to his brother to speak to his Jewish manager and see what he could suggest in the circumstances. This position was aggravated by the fact that the king, seeing no other way out, had decided to have Maximilian's estates taken over by the government and sold in order to meet the taxes due on them. Meshi Yitzchak listened to Prince Ferdinand's story and promised he would see what could be done in the matter and would let him know as soon as possible if and how Prince Maximilian's estates could be saved. A short while passed by, and Meshi Yitzchak thought of a plan as to how the prince could be saved from bankruptcy. But as he did not want to say anything about this plan until everything would be in perfect order, he kept the plan to himself. When Mishael Yitzchok Sobel had thoroughly looked into Prince Maximilian's ruined estates, he saw that under proper management, order could be restored, and he knew exactly where he could find the right people for the job. There were three Jews in Prague named Mordechai Meisel, Mordechai Tzemach, and Elchanan Brandeis. They were all three wealthy, efficient businessmen. Mishael Yitzchok decided to ask these three to take over the leases of Prince Maximilian's estates. Mishael Yitzchok had already worked out in his mind how much the estates ought to bring in under an efficient management and supervision. He reckoned that the income should be large enough not only to cover all outstanding debts owed by the prince, but also to free his castle and still bring in an annual sum of money. Mishael Yitzchok calculated that it would pay these three wealthy Jewish businessmen to settle the prince's debt in advance. So Mishael Yitzchok went to Prague to interview them and to put his proposition before them. After consulting with each other and investigating the matter, they agreed with Mishael Yitzchok that it was a sound proposition, and that they stood to lose nothing, and so they undertook to lease the prince's estates on the terms and conditions named by Mishael Yitzchok. Now Mishael Yitzchok was able to go to Prince Ferdinand and report on the success of his venture. "You can now come to the assistance of your brother," he said to him, "and in a way that he will not quickly forget." Prince Ferdinand then arranged a meeting between his manager and Prince Maximilian, and the latter was delighted with the plan explained to him by Mishael Yitzchok. A few days later, Prince Maximilian had three Jews from Prague before him, and they took over the estates from him on the conditions arranged by Mishael Yitzchok. The prince was so relieved and pleased that he quickly went off to tell his father, the king, what had happened. But before the king had a chance to grasp what his son had told him, the head of the Catholic ecclesiastical authorities was announced, and entering the king's presence stated that he had come to remind the king that the royal dues to the church were still outstanding, and that they now had to be sent to the Pope. And not only did he demand the sum due, but claimed that the king must also pay the interest which had accrued during the delay. The king felt very uncomfortable while he explained that he would gladly pay all he owed. Unfortunately, however, he had to admit that the royal treasury was absolutely empty at the moment. Could he, the head of the Catholic ecclesiastical church, like the good and patriotic citizen that he was, advance the money out of the church funds? The ecclesiastical head replied that the coffers of the church were also empty, and added venomously, "Naturally, it is so. When the Christians complain that they are poor because the Jews take every bit of good out of the country." "That is very strange," replied the king. "Only yesterday I looked through the list of taxes received and noted that 90% of these taxes were paid by the Jews, because all the leaders of the churches, as well as many other titled people, are free of tax duty." The clergyman felt the thrust but said nothing. The king was now more eager than ever to accept the plan brought to him by his son in the name of the three Jews. And in fact, on that same day, the three businessmen presented themselves with the money, and the legal documents were then duly signed, and the transaction was completed. They took over the lease of the estates for a period of 15 years. Prince Maximilian offered Mishael Yitzchok a substantial sum of money for his trouble in acting as intermediary, but he refused to accept any payment. "I did not do this as a matter of business, but only out of friendship toward your brother and yourself," Mishael Yitzchok told him. The prince told his father about the Jewish manager, and the king was greatly impressed. Prince Maximilian was, in truth, so grateful to Mishael Yitzchok for the great favor he had done him, and which he would never forget, that he told him he wished to arrange a banquet in his honor, and that he should be the guest of honor. But Mishael Yitzchok begged them not to do anything of the sort. "If you paid me such a high honor," said Mishael Yitzchok, "the anti-Semites would be jealous of me. So please let us keep this affair just between the two of us. I am amply rewarded by your recognition of me as your friend." Years passed, and all went well with the estates taken over by the Jews. Their investment proved quite profitable, and the prince was likewise pleased. One day the king called a meeting of his advisors. As always, at the royal council were present his two sons, the cardinal always ready with his complaints against the Jews, now demanded that the king decree their complete expulsion from the entire kingdom. How much longer must we suffer from them, the cardinal thundered. They are enemies of the church and state. They must not be tolerated anymore. I say we should drive them out of the country and confiscate their property. This is the only way we can save their sinful souls, he concluded with a hypocritical smile. The princes Maximilian and Ferdinand were the first to say a good word for the Jews. The Jews were useful to the land they claimed, and everybody knew how much they had achieved. On the contrary, they were of the opinion that Jews should be granted even greater freedom, more rights, and better opportunities. The country could only benefit from such a change. The king, too, was friendly in his words about the Jews. The Jews were good business people, efficient and conscientious workers, and the best payers of taxes. Whatever they undertook, they did thoroughly and with great success. All of the estates they took over on lease, they managed in the best possible manner. There was none to equal them in this respect. Why then this talk of tolerating them when the land could only benefit from their presence? Prince Maximilian warmly added that he could tell them of his own experience with Jews. Now, just take as an example, these three Jews, Meisel, Tzemach, and Brandeis, who are my estate managers. Everyone knows in what a decrepit state my estates were when these three Jews took over management. And mark you, they had been previously managed by non-Jews. What a difference the position is now. I draw a goodly income and all my debts are paid. And that is not all. These Jewish managers of my estates have, in the short time they're in charge, achieved literally wonders. They have built mills, inns, and other undertakings, giving employment to many people. They have revived the entire neighborhood bordering on my estates. And I just tremble to think what will become of everything if these and such Jews are driven out of the land. As for me, I suppose I shall again be reduced to handing over the management of my estates to a German who will only bring ruination upon me. I just can't bear to think of it. But the anti-Semites sang a different tune. They maintained that it would be an advantage to drive out the Jews, for then they would confiscate their property and possessions, turn them into cash, and the coffers of the church and government would again be filled. Another bright suggestion submitted was that if they intended to drive out the Jews, the quicker and more sudden was the expulsion, the better, for the Jews would then have no time to smuggle their money and jewels out of the country. Yes, another agreed. This expulsion must come like a bolt from the blue, so that the surprise of it should catch the Jews unprepared. These suggestions made an appeal to all those present who cared nothing for justice and humanity. But the king was shocked and cried out, "Would you turn me into a common robber?" And he looked around to see if there was anyone to support him apart from his own two sons. King Ferdinand, ruler over Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia, looked in vain for support in his defense of the Jews. The majority voted for the expulsion of the Jews, saying that this was the wish of the Pope, hoping that by this means he might force a number of them to conversion to the Catholic faith. The king and the two princes, Maximilian and Ferdinand, were helpless in the face of the overwhelming majority, who were now discussing the time limit they should allow the Jews to get out of their country. It was decided that the decree should be carried out within a period of 2 years. The clergy demanded that the Jews be ordered to attend church services, and that the heads of the Jewish community be deprived of any right to deter them. They hoped this would be a preliminary to conversion. When the Jews heard of the decrees against them, they were much more disturbed at the thought that Jews were expected to go to the church than they were even at the thought of being driven out of the countries which had been their homes for so long. As soon as the head of the Jewish community in Prague received the decree, he immediately hurried with it to the chief rabbi of Prague, the Maral. The decree stated that the Jews were being given 2 years in which to get out of the country. It also contained the order that Jews who so desired should attend church services without let or hindrance by any Jewish authority. The Maral immediately called a mass meeting of Jewish men, women, and children to take place the following morning after the first minyan in the synagogue courtyard. Young men were quickly dispatched throughout the city to inform all the Jews of the forthcoming gathering, which not one of them dare miss. Meanwhile, the Jews did not know what the convocation was being called for, but they realized it must be for some serious reason, for such a mass meeting had never yet been called in Prague. During the night, a huge platform was fixed in the synagogue courtyard, and when the Jews began to assemble in the morning and saw this huge bima, they were very alarmed, feeling a premonition that it stood there for some very grave reason. As soon as the davening was finished, all the doors of the synagogue were opened, and the first one to emerge was the Maral himself. He was wearing his talis and tefillin and was carrying a sefer Torah. Following him was the head of the community, Mordechai Meisel, also in talis and tefillin and also carrying a sefer Torah. Behind them, similarly attired and carrying sefer Torah, were all the rabbis and leaders of the community. They all arranged themselves on the platform standing. This threw a feeling of fear throughout the audience. What could all of this mean? They did not have to wait long for the answer. The Maral stepped forward and called out, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. The congregation burst out into a torrent of weeping. They knew that some dreadful calamity was threatening them. The Maral and all the others on the platform were also weeping. When the audience quieted down a little, the Maral again addressed them. Listen, you sons and daughters of Israel. By this prayer of Shema Yisrael, our ancestors became the victors over the ancient Greeks who wanted to destroy the Jewish faith and desecrate the Holy Temple. With this Shema Yisrael, Jews flung themselves into battle against their enemies and thus hallowed the name of the Almighty. May this Shema Yisrael of today light the fire of sacrifice in our hearts too, and give us the strength and courage to withstand all trials and temptations. The Maral then continued, the nation among whom we live is a friendly one. The king and his family are also friendly toward us. But sad to relate, the head of the Catholic Church is our enemy, and he wants to pit his strength against the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Maral then gravely read out the decree of the king, stating that Jews were to come to hear the sermons of the Catholic priests, that no Jew dare raise a finger to stop them. The reading of the decree brought a new deluge of tears among the audience. The weeping and wailing rose to a high pitch, and many women fainted. Elderly Jews washed their faces, their bitter tears. Maral allowed the people a little time in which to calm down, and then asked for silence. Let us cease our weeping, he said to them, and let us show no more weakness. Let us rather show how strong we are, and all of us, men, women, and children, young and old, all to sanctify God's holy name. Let us all swear before the Sefer Torah that not one of us will go to hear the sermon of a Catholic priest. And in the event that any one of us are taken to their churches forcibly, we will stop up our ears and not listen to them. Are you all in agreement and willing to take the oath, he called out. We gladly take this oath, they all cried out in unison. We swear by our very lives and the lives of our children that we will never listen to the sermons of Catholic priests on religious matters. Maral then asked the congregation to repeat word for word after the reader what he would recite. The Chazan then recited the Shema Yisrael and then the Baruch Shem and Hashem Elokim Hu Elokim, just like on Yom Kippur. The Shofar was then sounded and the Kohanim advanced and pronounced the priestly benediction. When this was all done, the Maral, together with the other rabbis of Prague, prepared a petition to the king, asking that he rescind this decree which forbids any Jewish leader from interfering with Jews attending church services. That was something that every rabbi and Jewish leader was obliged to do. They also stated that every Jew had given his oath to abide by his religion. Under the circumstances, the king wished to avoid a national tragedy, for the Jews were ready to sacrifice their lives if necessary. He graciously annulled the decree he had issued and saved a lot of trouble. At the same time, the Merala and the other leaders of the Jewish community called on Prince Ferdinand and protested the insolence of the Catholic priests who had begun to come among the Jews and insult them and their faith. This had already resulted in several clashes, for some of their non-Jewish neighbors, who were on very good terms with their Jewish neighbors, had attacked these Catholic priests when they had annoyed their Jewish friends near their home. On more than one occasion, these overbearing Catholic priests had to be forcibly driven out of the Jewish neighborhood. These priests jumped at this to bring libels against the Jews, which resulted in a number of them being arrested. The 2 years were practically over, but they showed little to the advantage of the Catholics. Not even one Jew had, during this time, so much as stepped in voluntarily into a church. And when the priests used force to have Jews brought into their churches, the Jews would stop up their ears and refuse to listen. Despite their efforts, all that the Catholic priests could show in the nature of a success was the conversion of exactly 3 Jews. And who do you think these converts were? One was a Jew who, poor fellow, had been insane for 15 years. The second had had no connection with Jews from his early childhood. And the third was the black sheep of the Jewish community, always rolling around the streets completely drunk. And it cost the church authorities quite a bit of money to bring even these 3 prizes to conversion. They saw to their bitter disappointment that by fair means or foul, by promises, bribes, or other means, they had failed in their attempt to convert the Jews. The Catholics could do nothing to stir them from their faith, to which the Jews tenaciously remained loyal and true. 3 months before the end of the 2-year limit given to the Jews to get out of Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia, the head of the Catholic Church called on King Ferdinand to remind him of his decree against the Jews and request assurance that he would carry it out. It was the worst possible time for this, as the treasury was pretty empty, and if the Jews were going to be driven out, who would fill the empty coffers? But the king saw no way out of it. He had issued the decree and had to stick to it. But he felt very badly about it. He talked the matter over with his 2 sons, who advised him to send one of the Jewish leaders of the community to Rome and beg the Pope to release King Ferdinand of the decree forced upon him against his will by the cardinal. The king thought it was certainly worth trying. The man chosen for this delicate mission was Mordechai Tzemach of Prague. Luckily, he found favor in the eyes of the Pope, Pius IV, who had succeeded Paul IV, but was much friendlier in his attitude toward Jews than his predecessor. And so, to the great relief and joy of Mordechai Tzemach, the Pope agreed to release King Ferdinand from being bound by his decree. The king now left the whole question in the hands of his son Prince Maximilian, who had constantly been postponing the date of the expulsion of the Jews from the land. And the year 5323, in this 1563, approximately, he abolished the decree entirely. In the year 5361, 1601, the leader of the Jewish community in Prague, Mordechai Meisel, passed away, and his place was taken by the grandson of the Maral, Shmuel, who we spoke about earlier. The Maral died in the year 5369, on Chayel, the 18th day of Elul, at the age of 97. Before his death, the Maral had reserved 3 graves in Prague, one for himself, another for his wife, and the third for their only son, Bezalel. But after Rabbi Bezalel died and was buried in Cologne, where he had had the position of Rosh Yeshiva, the Maral had stated that the third grave should be for his grandson, Rabbi Shmuel. Soon after the death of his grandmother, Rabbi Shmuel became the father of a son, whom he named Yehuda Leib after his grandfather. Child grew up to be brilliant and very gifted scholar, but he had much trouble in his family life. His first wife died, leaving him to care for their children. He married again, and the second wife too died, leaving him with some more children to worry about. When Rabbi Shmuel reached the age of 79 years, he felt his end approaching. He therefore had someone come from the Chevra Kadisha and reminded him that the third grave near the Maral belonged to him. But there was hardly any room there, protested the man. That was so. In the course of the years, there had been so many important Jews who had expressed the desire to be buried as near as possible to this great man that the third grave which the Maharal had brought was squeezed to nothing. "I insist on my right to be buried in this particular grave," persisted Rabbi Shmuel. "All I can suggest is that you go to the grave of the Maharal, my grandfather, and remind him that this third grave belongs to me." It is told that Rav Shmuel's suggestion was in fact followed, and that when he died in the year 5415, that's 1655, the grave had somehow become sufficiently extended for him to be buried beside his grandparents. He had later inherited quite a large fortune from his father. After the death of his second wife, Yehuda Leib married someone from Posen, and therefore decided to settle in this town. He was at this time 58 years old. In the year 5423, his third wife presented him with a son, whom they named Moshe. And here we come that these were the ancestors of Rabbi, the father of the Alter Rebbe, and this concludes the tale of Rav Baruch Batlan, as well as the tales told by Rav Baruch Batlan.